Hello, hello. Can you hear me?
Hey.
What's up?
No, thank you.
Whenever you're ready, okay? No rush.
Thanks.
What's
Hey.
up? How you doing?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can't see
You're in
you
a coffee
though.
shop?
Yeah.
Yeah. Every time I put on my video, it kills my connection.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
I
I'll
can try. I can try today. There's a guy who should be joining us, who mailed me. He was put on to Quilt by Tracy Kurt.
Okay, cool.
What is his mail? Just trying to remember. Or I can't find his email that he sent me. I'll recognize his name when he joins. But he's interested in getting involved. He's a developer at Cisco.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think I might have seen that email actually.
Were you copied on it? Cool. Well then,
Can't
yeah,
remember.
him. Yeah, Sarabjit.
Yeah. Oh, so were you in contact with him after, or
Yeah, so
just?
I mailed him and said, "Cool, we're having this call, join." And I sent in the details.
Awesome.
It is 3 p.m. UTC, right?
I don't know what the UTC is. I think I'm 5 off or 6.
Yeah,
So yeah,
no, it
makes
is,
sense.
it is. Well, it is today. So I don't think it changes. Yeah, it follows UTC. Anyway, what's
Yeah.
happening? Sorry, I've got a bit of a cold if I sound like a bit like I'm underwater.
Yeah, no worries. I think I just need someone to talk to, honestly. Like, I've been kind of stuck in the weeds with mapping BTP to the ILPv4 flow in Java. And I think what's killing me is there's three different patterns at work. One is the WebSocket pattern in Java, which is all callback.
Yeah.
The second is my plugin is all completable future.
Okay.
And then I'm kind of noticing like BTP is very like seems very async, right? Like you fire off a BTP message, you get an ACK, and then you wait for the response, like on the incoming, like you know, as like a separate message. What's weird though is like the way I've designed my connector and plugin architecture is like BTP sits at the edge on a WebSocket, and basically it's WebSocket, right? So a binary message comes in at the WebSocket layer. It moves into a BTP, so I like basically translate from binary message, which is like kind of pure WebSocket, into a BTP message. I then translate from a BTP message into effectively an ILP prepare packet, right? And so I kind of it moves from like an async model to what feels like a sync model in ILP, because at least the way I've written the plugin is the there's a maybe I can share my screen if it's helpful, but like there's a prepare method that returns a completable future. So the in and the out are connected at the
But
Java
why do
layer.
you say it goes from async to sync?
It's all async, but
But BTP is not really async.
so may,
BTP
yeah,
is
maybe
very
I'm
much like request response.
it is, but the like the I you think of it like two channels. When you so imagine you're the am I breaking up or
No, you did. Now you're back.
okay, let me shut off my video. when, okay, so it's all async. I guess what's a little problematic is in the current like Java 8 Spring WebSocket code, the when you want to send a message out, you call session.send message effectively.
Yeah, yeah.
But the response you get back at the BTP layer, like you get an ACK immediately, meaning that message actually like made it to the server. But the BTP response comes back as a
ACK,
an incoming message.
ACK, I don't think that ACK is an ACK. I think that it, that callback, when you call send on a WebSocket, the callback is a notification that the outgoing stream has been flushed.
When you call ACK on a WebSocket or in BTP?
When you call send, like in the WS library in JavaScript, when you call send, that callback has nothing to do with the recipient getting the message. That callback is just a callback that the message has been sent.
Okay. So the BTP ACK, is that going to come as a...
There's no such thing as a BTP ACK at the moment. I'm proposing it.
I think there is. It's called... let me look up the spec here. I'll share my screen.
No.
All right, let's try... Here, can you see me?
Where are you looking? Yeah, okay. BTP, yep.
Yep. Okay, so this response. So you
That's
send
an actual
a,
response.
Let's see. Where's my flow here? Sorry, I am looking for
flow. You just went past it.
Yeah, let me go to the send data. So response is returned if the message is acknowledged, right?
Yeah.
And if you have like my read of this, maybe I'm misunderstanding, was like it's kind of like a synchronous response. So if you have like an immediate response, great. Otherwise, when you want to send the fulfill, send it as a new message. Is that wrong?
Yeah, that's wrong.
Okay, so fulfill comes in as a response, right?
Yeah, so basically all BTP gives you is effectively a frame with request response matching.
Okay.
And it used to have this concept of a transfer message because they try to model basically send data and send money.
Yeah.
But in fact, it does still use transfer, I think, but I'm proposing we ditch it. But anyway.
Gotcha.
So basically you send a request with an ID and a bunch of sub protocols in that request. And then in the response, you expect to get the same set of sub protocols with the responses from each protocol. And that sucks because that doesn't make any sense. Like in terms of maybe you can respond to one quickly and you can't respond to the other or whatever. So my proposal in BTP3 is just have one sub protocol per frame.
Yeah, I like that. I want to come back to that because it, I had some questions around the auth protocol, but I think let's come back to that in a second. But just to tie this one off, if I look at this request response, like here, I can go into some of my, have this BTP socket handler.
Yeah.
So if you look here, this is it's a binary WebSocket handle, like this is Spring, it's pure WebSocket, right?
Yeah. You get send message.
Okay. So this is like on an incoming. So imagine I'm a server and I get an incoming message. Like I handle the incoming here and I
use and get back a binary message, which you send back, right?
Yeah. So this is actually like, there is no response in WebSocket. It's actually like a new outgoing message.
Exactly. So that's what the BTP layer adds. So WebSockets just has a duplex stream. BTP is a way of basically labeling each frame with an ID so you can match request and response.
Yes. Okay. So this is fine. Like, this arguably works because whoever's listening on the other side of this WebSocket session will, you know, correlate on the request ID, right?
Yeah.
So what's problematic is in the connector, like here, I can show you this logic. Here I have a client BTP plugin, which means we're in a connector. This plugin will connect to another connector, and this client will be the client. It'll be the WebSocket client, right?
Okay. So for the purposes of establishing the socket, it's the client.
Exactly. So what happens is the connector figures out where it wants to forward a packet, and it makes its way into here to do a send data over BTP, right?
Yeah.
So I convert the BTP into WebSocket land. Great.
Yeah.
I can actually send that binary message out to the next peer, right?
Yep.
But the response, there is no response here. Like, I actually have to wait for the response on a totally different piece of code, which is way down here in here.
Yep.
So I need to connect somehow an incoming message here and send it back into this completable future up here. And I, you know, without writing a bunch of like join code,
what you have to do.
Yeah.
So that was my previous, I'm trying to remember when I implemented something along these lines.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if it was even, but basically, yeah, you need you basically have to maintain a queue, and you keep a record of your sent messages, and when you get back a response, you correlate incoming messages, you look at the message type, if it's a response, you check that you actually sent the request, and then attached to that is an unfulfilled promise, or in your case, a future, then you complete that future with the response.
Yep. Okay, so like basically what I've been, I don't know, I guess maybe that's just what needs to happen.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's, like, there's no real other way of doing it. Like your outgoing connection to the other connector is just duplex stream. That's all you have. That's all WebSockets gives you. So the nice thing about WebSockets is it, like, it can do nice, you know, handshakes when it establishes. So it could do auth. It can do some funky stuff like protocol negotiation. But at the end of the day, you've just got this basically what looks like a raw TCP socket. And it gives you a framing protocol. So you can send messages, say whether they're binary or text, frame them. And so on the other side, you know you're getting a complete message each time. And then that's all it gives you. To turn that into request response, you actually have to do the heavy lifting of like enveloping each message with a request ID and a correlation ID, matching them on the other side, all of that stuff. Yeah. I played around a bit. That was where I was getting quite excited about using Camel at one point.
Yeah.
You know, all of those concepts are sort of built in, but it was driving me nuts. It was like,
it's like a whole stack.
And it was frustrating. But it's actually, I mean, I implemented in JavaScript. If you want to look at my implementation of BTP3 actually does this.
Okay.
If you want to look at how I did it, it's, I mean, literally in the socket.
I forget where your stuff was.
I keep two maps. I'll share my screen with you.
Yeah.
Good tunes in the background there.
Yeah. I don't have my AirPods in, so it's not noise canceling very well.
Can you see my screen?
Yeah.
No, that's not what I want. I want that to go.
Look at you, man. JavaScript.
For the win. I must say, I'm really enjoying TypeScript. TypeScript is quite cool.
Yeah.
It's sort of the best of both worlds. It's still frustrating, but I'm kind of getting used to it.
Yeah.
So basically, this should be easier to kind of copy from because it's class based, if you like. So I've got basically a BTP socket, and it's an event emitter. So it can basically, instead of you registering callbacks with it, it just emits events, and you listen for those and handle them. So
yeah, that's smart.
What I do is you pass it a raw web socket, and then it keeps a map of sent messages and received messages. And it does some garbage collection on those. So when I get an incoming message, I call handle data, which does basically splits out into what type of message is it, blah, 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 blah. It tries to deserialize it. If that fails, it emits an error. But let's say it's a request, which is here. I first check, because of item potency, did I get this request before? If so, just return the same response I sent last time.
Yeah.
But if assuming it's new, I create this received request thing, which basically just tracks the state of a received message. So I pass it in the packet, and I score it based on the ID that it's used in the map. That's that there.
Yeah.
And then I send back an ACK packet. Like, you wouldn't do that now because there's no ACKs in BTP.
Yeah.
And then I send the ACK. That's this bit here. And then I emit this request event. And the request event has a callback on it, which allows the receiver of the event to pass back a response, either a message or an error.
Gotcha.
So that's on the receive. That's on the receiving a request side. If I am handling a response, I check if I've received it before, which means I never act the response. So that's kind of not that important for you now. But otherwise, I go and look for the original request in my sent messages map.
Yeah.
Based on the correlation ID. If I couldn't find it, I return back an error. If I can find it, I send back an ACK and say, I got it, and I pass it up as an event.
Yeah, sweet.
Well, actually, so actually, what? Sorry, I don't pass it up as an event. I received the from the original message. I have this response received function attached to that state management thing, and I'll show you what that does. And that basically calls a callback that was registered when the person first called send.
Okay.
So let me take you to how that would have started. The guy would have called request here. He would have passed in a BTP message, and he would have got back a promise which resolved to another BTP message.
Yeah.
So I immediately, this is your fulfillable future. I immediately return him that promise, and then I've got the callback I would call when I get the response, or a callback I call when I get, if I want to throw an error. And that's standard JavaScripty stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I construct the frame, so I frame the message you gave me, an ID, it's type request. I create this like state management thing, the sent message state object, and then I attach event listeners to that thing. So that state object of that request has a bunch of events it can release. It can emit an ACK when the thing was ACK, response when a response came back, error if there was an error, or a timeout if I never got the timeout. And then within that state object, I'm basically running a timer to retry ACKing and then eventually erroring if it retries too many times and stuff like that. But it's basically this little object I create with the packet that I'm about to send. And it's got a bunch of callbacks which will fire when any of those events happen. And one of them will be when it gets a response, it calls the, it basically resolves the promise with that response. Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. But there's no way of getting around basically having this map of sent messages. I mean, that's this thing here. And the sent
messages. It's kind of like a queue, but not really. Like a queue.
No, it's just a map.
Yeah, a queue wouldn't have a handle to like incoming.
Yeah, it's there's no ordering. It's you're indexing by the ID, but you also need to do some sort of garbage collection on it because it'll grow infinitely, right?
Right.
So what I do is every event that happens on here. So this object that I create is basically keeping the packet. And then it's keeping a bunch of state information and pointers to callbacks and things. So
okay,
when you create it, you basically then at any point in time, I can call sent when it was sent, and that'll change the state and it'll restart some timers to wait for the response. When I get the ACK for it, I call that, it changes the state to say that it was ACK, and it clears the ACK timeout. And emits the ACK event. And then response does the same. You know, it emits that response event with the actual response. But it basically does a bunch of stuff like that. And what's important is this property here, last modified, my garbage collecting logic calls this it's configurable, but every second. And all right. It basically looks when the state of this message was last modified. And if it's older than a certain amount of time, it just deletes it out of the map.
What's your, say that again, how long do you wait?
At the moment, I think I'm like 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
It's configurable. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty crude. Like you probably want to be able to do things like if it's in an error state, you can get rid of it quicker and whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, the garbage collection logic is literally, this is it at the moment. Here.
Yeah.
Loop through sent messages, loop through receive messages. You know, if the last modifier is greater than the configured expiry, delete them.
Yeah.
And then rerun this function basically in another second time.
Yeah. So one thing, both of us are kind of going down this model where the request and the response are tied together in memory.
Yeah.
And it's just occurring to me like a truly scalable, you know, sort of async system would not be memory bound, right? Like it would put the request onto a queue.
But you do have to have a way to map your requests and responses. You right now it is memory bound, but you could put like that message store could be external. Like it could be a Redis cache or something that you drop onto, and then, so I mean, you could persist them somewhere else, I guess.
I don't
have that for now. But the way the BTP plugin works.
Go ahead.
You say again. The way the BTP plugin works today is exactly like this. Like if you, I think I've actually got it. LP plugin BTP does this in a way less understandable way, but it's exactly what it does. It's like,
how can you tell me more there, because I from what I can tell in the current connector, it just has a promise somehow, and like it's almost like some internal library is able to connect the incoming and the outgoing WebSocket messages without doing all this.
Sorry, I'm about to sneeze. Whew, sex. Thanks.
I don't know if you're I still see the socket.ts. Maybe you're only sharing like one window.
Oh, it's sharing that window. Give me a second. How do I change that? New share. ILP plugin BTP.
There we go.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Let's make sure I'm looking at the right thing now. Okay.
So like somehow they're able to wait on a promise from.
Yeah. So he's awaiting this. So it's the magic, I think, happens in this call thing. So he's pulling away this call. And call returns a promise, which resolves to a buffer, obviously. It resolves to obviously an ILP response, which so he does the parsing down here. But call is good. So you get the you basically request ID out of the packet, and it does a very sneaky thing, is it creates a new event identifier using underscore callback and the request ID.
And it
binds a listener on that event that is only fired once, which is basically what that does. So it's
That's very JavaScript
magic.
That's why I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, so when you'll see when it handles an incoming packet. It's setting a timeout, removing the event listener after
that's sweet.
Rejecting the promise.
Freaking JavaScript.
Yeah. So you see here the response there is your promise, which gets returned. Outgoing packet.
why not do that? Why not keep that in your code? Like why actually make the mapping kind of like first class?
Because I want to handle more than one state change. I don't want to just wait for a response. I've introduced the idea of acts. So the problem with this is the way this, we had acts before and took them out because people thought they were too complicated. Yeah. But the problem is you have no reliable delivery then. You have no somebody in a communications channel like that, somebody has to be responsible for, you know, did the message get delivered? Especially if messages have side effects. So if I send you a prepare packet, you get back the fulfill and you can't deliver it to me. I have no idea if you ever got the prepare. So as far as I'm concerned, like I can decide you never did. And then you know, I don't owe you any money. Meanwhile, you did get the prepare. You passed it on. You got the fulfill. You couldn't deliver the fulfill. And as far as you're concerned, I do owe you money. So the way that normally works in card protocol, so ISO 8583, is they have it gets complicated because there's sort of you can use different message types to do it slightly differently. They have a concept of positive and negative completion. So if I send you a message that has a side effect, so I send you like a transaction message and it times out, you don't respond in time, I then queue a reversal of that and I basically keep sending that reversal to you till you acknowledge it.
Okay.
And the idea is you need to be able to reverse whatever you just did. Now we can't do reversing, so we can't do that. So that's a negative completion, I think. Positive completion is I send you the message and I assume you haven't got it until you acknowledge it.
Okay.
So I just keep sending.
And that's what you've introduced.
And you need item potency. So I need to be able to send you the same message 100 times. You need to be able to recognize that it is the same message.
I noticed in the BTP spec, the verbiage is kind of strange to me. It's like, kind of calls that out and says, because it would be too slow to atomically save all request IDs, they are not idempotent. And I went with it because it's in the spec, but I don't get what that means. Like,
I think,
why would it be too slow?
It should say they are idempotent. They're idempotent with an expiry. So, like, if you send me a request, I expect you not to use the same request ID for a different request for a certain amount of time.
Okay.
I think that, you know, so that needs to roughly correlate with how I'm set up my garbage collection as well. Like, I'm not going to just remember every request you've ever sent me. And then try and match against it. But at the same time, I do need some level of item potency to make sure that if you send me a message, like, and I don't respond to you, you know how to handle that. And right now, my proposal in 3 is you send it again.
So just to clarify, in BTP 2, is this just saying you can't have two different requests with the same ID, or is it actually saying you can't send the same request twice? Otherwise, it will be treated like two different requests.
I don't know how it's been implemented, to be honest.
It says it's the responsibility of the requester to make sure they don't duplicate request IDs. The implementation should ensure no two in-flight requests are sent out with the same ID. That is obvious. And the responder should always send back a response to a request with the same request ID. That makes sense. What does not make sense in BTP2 is how it can be up to the sender to ensure they don't send a request twice. Like, what if some intermediate network infrastructure, you know, retries?
Exactly. I don't know. And that's those are the holes that I think exist in BTP as it is today.
Okay.
And that's what I'm kind of trying to solve for with the version 3.
Not right now, thanks. Okay. You want to jump into version 3? Like, I had a couple.
Sure.
I guess questions. Like, really, my I don't know why they are using an incrementing int. Like, UUID seems better.
Yeah, incrementing int worries me as well, because I feel like if you I'm just trying to find.
Like, it might collide with.
Well, you also, like, you've got to statefully somewhere store what your last message ID was to the other host.
Yeah.
Which is a terrible idea.
And like, restarting the server.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that actually exists here. The request ID is a function here today. I mean, today they don't use an incrementing number. They actually use a random number anyway. Using a UUID for anyway. It's just
I'm trying to think there, I can't remember where the, maybe it's in BTP, somewhere there's a it's in the routing code, there's a UUID, but it's encoded as a, I believe a 16-byte number, or is it, no, 32-byte number, sorry.
16-byte is right.
Is it? Yeah.
It's 128-bit is a UUID.
Yes. So there's already a codec. Well, I wrote it for the routing stuff. But
cool.
Rather, I don't know how you're
serializing. I mean, UINT 128. I'm serializing it as...
Oh, great. Yeah, okay.
Cool. 16 bytes, basically.
Sweet. So I like that. The only, like...
What does it do?
From a super high level, I want... Like, at Ripple, we have problems with WebSockets in real production infrastructure.
Okay. Right?
One, some customers are just unfamiliar and reticent to deploy it. And then the other thing is that it doesn't always flow through firewalls well, because it's sort of, it's not common, especially like in an enterprise use case. So one thing I've been thinking about is whatever we do for BTP3 or BTP2 for that matter, I would really love to create some other transport. Like, I'm thinking of gRPC specifically, which is just a custom protocol over HTTP2. So the things that caught my eye mostly were like the things that got pushed down into the WebSocket layer, like the sub protocol, for example. So I just want to be careful that, like, it's fine. Like, auth is one, I would be fine if auth is handled at the WebSocket layer, as long as like a different transport binding would be able to do that also. But there's some things that like gRPC or like a pure socket may not be able to handle easily. Mm. And it seems like those things should stay in BTP. So like, I guess the version was one, like we could push that into the WebSocket protocol, sub-protocol, right? But something, some other, like, imagine you were trying to do BTP over a pure socket that doesn't have a sub-protocol thing.
Right.
It seems like it might be better just to leave that in BTP. I don't know if you have thoughts there.
I mean, my journey in playing with all of this stuff was I built a whole framing protocol of my own to start, because I was thinking like WebSocket does have these issues that people, you know, do complain about, and so I thought maybe, you know, a raw TCP connection with a different framing protocol would be better. My conclusion was, actually, like, this is basically reinventing the wheel, and BTP and WebSockets basically does everything I needed to do. So, you know, I think you can get around a lot of firewall issues by just using different ports. So, like, you could have a WebSocket server that listens on a different port. And make it a secure server, so it's using certificates and so on. A firewall would be none the wiser when an HTTPS request comes in on that port, you know, and authenticates and so on. I don't know. I don't know the specific operational issues around firewalls and WebSockets. The other thing I was sort of reticent about was, you know, can we actually make it work with other types of underlying socket implementation? And it turns out Node.js actually makes it pretty easy to use WebSockets over a Unix socket as opposed to a TCP socket. So that was fine as well. And I was hoping that would dramatically improve performance or make it easier to use, for example, two processes, you know, on the same machine that want to communicate. My early tests suggest that actually sockets are not better, especially for very big messages, but I need to keep testing that.
That's interesting.
I guess the thinking here is like use something standardized, because almost every stack has a WebSocket library that works pretty well. All we care about is basically the binary framing. And in my case, I'm suggesting that you could use the HTTP handshake for authentication, but you don't have to.
Yeah.
I just think that's it's an implementation mechanism, a way of implementing BTP that people are familiar with. Like a lot of people have already got hooks for handling an HTTP request with auth headers or client certificates authenticating. Yeah. And then, you know, using that as part of the flow rather than a custom like auth protocol thing.
Yeah. In fact, that bit me in the Spring libraries, because the code is actually, there's a like basically the equivalent of an auth handler, but the way it's written, you can't, it's actually like the first thing part of the handshake and or the negotiation.
Yeah.
And so if you want to do auth in that layer, you can't actually get into the WebSocket handler to like
look at the BTP. Yeah, exactly. And that's I remember that from trying to implement it, and that was one of the things that like grated me. So I do think it's worth still supporting auth protocol at the BTP layer if somebody decides that's how they want to do it. They want to like separate the two, so you have an authenticated connection between two hosts, but then you have a separate application layer authorization through BTP, whatever. I mean, maybe they want to do that.
I'm thinking more along the lines of like profiles. Like one thing that's a little, I don't know, confusing is that BTP kind of assumes WebSocket sometimes, but doesn't really mandate it. And so I guess like what I'd like to see is like if BTP 3 is like, hey, there's things like support and auth that we can actually get for free in WebSocket. It feels like there should be a profile of BTP 3 called BTP 3 WebSocket, right? And then per that profile, you do auth in the standard way of WebSockets or HTTP would. And then like, I'd love to have a parallel profile of BTP 3, which is like BTP 3-gRPC. And in that case, there's a way, like it's standard, you know, TLS auth basically. But what would be missing in gRPC would be, well, it'd be a different way of some of the framing and request correlation, right? So gRPC is handling request correlation for you in their way. And so again, not something we need in the BTP layer, actually. Like we assume that the transport can do that in the same way that
gRPC can already do that stuff. Yeah.
Well, I think you're, well, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe not. I guess you do still have a request ID.
Yeah.
Anyway, like
the thing is, if you use gRPC, you could just pass ILP packets directly. Because I think gRPC already supports that pattern, like of sending a request, getting back response, and so on.
What's missing is the, the request correlation is there, but what's missing is the semantic of a BTP message, or in BTP2, like that transfer thing. So I still think there's like one protocol layer. Like if you imagine you had a sandwich of ILP and gRPC, we'd still be missing, I think, this bilateral ledger protocol, right? Or no? I mean,
No. So basically, I think where we've ended up is having that stuff at the BTP layer makes no sense. Like, certainly my thinking is, basically BTP should just be a way of matching requests and responses and reliably knowing whether they were delivered or not. Then it supports the idea of within that construct saying, here's a bunch of protocol, here's a bunch of messages I'm sending you, and they might be ILP, but they might be something else. And then if you want to do like send money, you'll have a money protocol. But most people actually don't want to do send money. Most people just want to send ILP packets.
Yeah.
Like the trend seems to be towards moving the balance logic down to the plugins as opposed to doing it in the connector.
Right.
Which means the connector literally just becomes a router. It's exchanging root information and it's receiving packets and sending them out over another connection and then getting a response and sending their response back over the same original connection. So that's literally all it does. It's like a stateful connector that's able to match requests and responses.
So, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you just brought up a great point, which is like, there's the ILP subprotocol of BTP, right? So imagine I have a connector that speaks gRPC only, and I'm just doing ILP over gRPC.
Yeah.
What I have no support for are any other BTP subprotocols, like send money.
But I would think of gRPC as a replacement for BTP and the subprotocol frame. So you kind of need a separate gRPC connection for each sub protocol or separate, I don't know, session or something.
That's where I'm wondering if BTP shouldn't be its own thing that can run over different transports, because if you can speak BTP, you're going to write all your BTP logic in like a BTP layer. And then sometimes you might speak it over WebSocket. Sometimes you might speak it over gRPC.
What you mean.
Sometimes you might speak it over a carrier pigeon.
Yeah, I guess you could. What you could do is come up with BTP over gRPC, and then your packets would be the same, but you'd strip out all the request response ID matching, correlation ID stuff.
Sorry, you broke up. Say it again.
So if you said, okay, I'm going to come up with BTP over gRPC,
yeah,
you could basically replicate the exact same packets, types, and packet content, but you could get rid of the request IDs and correlation IDs and the acts. So you could say, gRPC already gives me that stuff, so here's a different packet format which just has protocol name, content type, and then payload.
Protocol name, yeah, right. I guess, yeah, it'd be just like a different binding, but like the same sub-protocol handler framework.
Yeah, that's basically, make the most sense.
I'm not sure if that's useful or not. Like, I know back when McKeel was on the team, and I see he posted here, like, sub-protocols was a thing. Like, we had vouch, and we had auth, and we had all these things, sent money protocol. But I guess, is that a thing or not? You know what I mean? Like, so to me, there should be a some protocol for request response matching. Yeah. And from what it looks like, what you're trying to do is that's WebSocket with your custom framing. And then there should be a different protocol, like BTP sub protocol, that can run over any transport.
Huh. I do quite like the idea of having, you know, protocols where you literally just, you provide the name, the content type, and then the payload. Because it does allow you to kind of multiplex a single transport.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of. I mean, in this instance, I'm saying put a single one in each packet, but that's also okay because it gets cumbersome for request response matching otherwise.
Right.
Interesting.
I guess what we're discussing is, does BTP even exist outside of its transport?
Does it exist outside of it? No, it's currently quite tied to WebSockets.
So in BTP2, it's not, right? Like, you could theoretically run BTP over any transport in BTP2.
Could you? It still needs framing, though. Still need something to be able to frame complete mess. Like, you couldn't do BTP2 over a raw TCP socket.
It still needs framing. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it needs some kind of something above a socket. Yes. But I guess as long as you had something like what? HTTP?
Yeah, I mean, HTTP, I would see as an alternative to WebSockets. Like, HTTP is also framing. The problem with HTTP is you have all the headers get sent with every request and every response. Like, there's a lot of overhead.
Okay.
And it's request response only. Like, there's no way to send any kind of unsolicited messages.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of, like, WebSocket and gRPC. So gRPC is just defining, like, a custom server push on HTTP2?
I think so.
So in a lot of ways, like the framing, that intermediate protocol is the framing. Like, so if I think about what these are, there's a BTP framing protocol, and then there's the BTP protocol itself, which has these sub-protocols.
Say that again.
Like, there's two parts of BTP, right?
Not sure if I'm following. Yeah.
The first part is framing. So in BTP2, we use WebSockets for framing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we use BTP itself for request response correlation.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just reading your comment here. Are you describing BTP3 here?
Say again?
Is this BTP3 that you're saying? You send a message, no response expected?
The response to Mihail? Yeah. It's basically trying to say that the difference between a message and a request, I should say that there's a differentiation between those in BTP3.
Okay. Why wouldn't a message get an ACK?
It would.
Oh, okay. So you send a message
and always expect an ACK. If you send a request, you may get an ACK.
So you see where you say and always expect an ACK?
Yeah.
Are you meaning to say and always expect an ACK in both cases?
Yeah.
Okay. Because the way you have it worded, it looks like you only get an ACK after, yeah, okay.
ACK and a response, or just an ACK. All packets are idempotent. Then, potent. So, can be sent if you don't. Guess that's probably enough. DJ asked some good questions here. So, like, why use UUID? I mean, my thinking there is UUID is, like, right now the implementation is using random 32-bit integers. UUID is a standard for random integers. We should just use it.
I think you
message and request, so I'm answering that as well.
Yeah.
Transfer packet. Yeah. Sort of posted with like a sub protocol mode. The ID and correlation ID is an interesting one. So I thought about this in the earlier designs of BTP, and nobody wanted to listen to me, but I'm going to try again. Basically, the idea here is when I send a request, the reply is a new message. And so it should have a new ID. The fact that it corresponds to a previous message is a separate property. So that's the correlation ID. Mm-hmm. That allows you to have a chain of messages that can all relate to one another. So I can send you a request, you can send me a response, and I can send you an error in response to your reply, an error as the reply to your response because it's malformed or, you know, whatever, some issue with your reply. Like maybe I couldn't find the original request. Now, how do I do that without you misinterpreting my error as reuse of the message ID for, you know, for incorrect purposes or something like that?
Yeah.
So anyway, I need to explain that
properly. I think we're going to lose the call here. Do you want to keep talking a little bit on?
Sure. Yeah. I'm gonna have to drop off pretty soon, but let's chat for 5 minutes.
Okay. Let me give me like 2 minutes, and I'll call you on Slack.
Okay. Cool.
Okay. Ciao.
Good morning, Vipin. How's it going?
Good morning. I'm on the streets of New York, so I'm going to remain mute.
All right. Folks on the line, we'll just give a few more minutes for others to join. I just posted the meeting notes link on the Rocket Chat channel. You can kind of go there and add yourself to the roster. Attending list. All right, it's five after. Maybe we should get started. Just quick reminder, I posted the link to the meeting doc. If you can go in there, we have on the top of it, we have our antitrust policy notice. I'm sure all of you are aware by now what that is. If not, please take a look at it. Just wanted to maybe have, you know, we had, I think, a good session at the face-to-face meeting. I caught the, I was there on the third. Hart, Mick, are you there? You want to give a summary of anything else that happened on the second day?
I don't have anything in particular. I spent most of my second day working on the Trustachenko proposal.
Ah, cool. Is that anything? Trusted chain code proposal. Okay. Does that fall into anything that we should capture in the Aqua group? Or?
Not at this point.
Okay.
So this is a very specific proposal for sort of combining some of the functionality of the private data objects with a fabric peer. So you get trusted execution in it. Trusted / confidential.
Great. Were there any further discussions on either identity or system entity identities or interoperability and so forth?
I guess Stan's not here. He would be the one to start answering that particular question. Okay. And Vipin, I know that there were a number of things that were being discussed about the identities. Was there any additional work on the identities paper?
I think
I'm on the streets of New York, so I have to kind of remain silent for a minute. I will, you know, if need be, we'll talk about what, you know, privacy and confidentiality specific stuff we talked about there.
Sounds good. So maybe we can start off quickly taking a look at the system identities paper and see whether Graham has added. Interoperability. Ledger system identities, here it is. posted a link to that as well on the Rocket Chat. So just to give a quick recap of what we did, you know, we had kind of two sessions during on the first day of the Hackfest, and you know, because we had quite a bit of new participants, we did kind of peel back and just give a quick overview of where we were on each of the tracks. The good news was there was a lot of interest, and hopefully more of those folks will join and contribute. I think the downside was we didn't make as much progress on the docs as we wanted to. So maybe we can just quickly look at where we are on each of those and then go from there. Okay, so this looks like, so we have our, the technical writer who's been helping us with finishing the papers is Gordon Graham, and Gordon kind of spent some time talking with the indie folks to capture some of their input, but I don't see that it has made it into the paper yet, so I'll touch base with him on that. Mick, any luck on the sawtooth input? I think we have a placeholder.
Yeah, I bugged Dan about it. He said it would just be a couple of paragraphs at most for it. So let me bug him again.
Okay. And Vipin, the Iroha guys did provide something, right? Was there enough information there that we could, from their paper, that we could just take, or do we need?
By the way, I'm from Iroha team. So if you have anything, suggestion, I can add.
Oh, fantastic. Who do we have? Sorry, who was speaking?
My name is Bulat.
Bulat, welcome to the team. We really appreciate you joining, and you know, so just to give you a quick overview of what we are doing in the identity paper. We have the overall kind of functional description of what needs to be done for each of the system identities functions, such as establishing a root of trust, enrollment, authentication and authorization, revocation, privacy, interoperable identifiers, and so forth. You can do a quick read of this and then document how these functions are handled in Iroha. That would be fantastic.
Okay.
And I do see that, a section here which says volunteer Bulat. So thanks for joining. So.
So I mainly wrote about how peer joining and peer organization works and accounts in Iroha, how they are validated, but just a couple of words.
Okay. So it'd be great, like, for instance, if let's take an example, right? So how does Bootstrap happen? We've talked about using either an external CA or self-signed search with some out-of-band trust establishment. you know, so it'll be good to get a couple of lines about how Iroha does Genesis and Bootstrap off the blockchain, if you will, right, for that section. So just follow the same format as the top sections that are there, which are describing the functional aspects of each service, if you will, under the identity services. And you know, just spend very briefly a couple of lines or as much as you need for each of those sections to describe how it's handled in Iroha. Because the emphasis on the top section is just the what, with just a few examples of how it could be done. But we want each of the projects to kind of describe how it's done in the in their section.
Yeah, okay, I got it.
Fantastic. Is Bin on the line today? Doesn't look like it. Okay. What else do we have? I don't see Nathan, but I think during the face-to-face, Gordon got some information from the indie team. So hopefully that will help flesh that out. We're in good shape there. We want to move to the interoperability paper. Let me post a link to that. That's on Rocket Chat as well. And unfortunately, Stan couldn't join today because he had a conflict. He said he put in a section in the intro to address some of, I think, Eduardo's comments on the during the face-to-face. And for those new to the call, just a quick recap. In the interop work item, what we're trying to do is to figure out what does interoperability mean and the different types of interoperability between ledgers, blockchains, if you will. And the approach we're trying to take is to first describe a few use cases and use those use cases to flesh out requirements for what needs to happen between ledgers. This is the outline skeleton that we have created, but it's still pretty early days of defining the interoperability mechanisms. The hope is to go from use cases to requirements to then describe the generic primitives that each ledger should have in order to enable meet the interoperability requirements. Any questions, comments? All right. So let's look at the top section. Any comments on the meaning and importance of interoperability in DLT that Stan has kind of put in? And I think you can see Eduardo's comments as well.
It looks pretty much fine to me.
I'm not sure whether in this document, we will not try to define interoperability is a pretty strong statement. We are trying in some sense to define different aspects of interoperability. So maybe we might need to modify that. That sounds good. Whoever did that. All right. And so the different use cases that we've had so far, you know, balance transfer from one ledger to another, and atomic swaps, identity interoperability, and cross-ledger anchoring are some of the use cases that we have. And there were a few others that came up, like revocable credentials, identity portability, and so forth. So I guess the high-level question is, do we have the outline and the different topics covered, or are we missing something major? Crickets.
Sorry, I'm trying to get your paragraph for the system identities done.
Ah, multitasking. Thank you.
Well, more like I've sufficiently been guilt tripped for not getting this done for weeks, so it's about time.
No worries. Let's context switch back to this one. So, Bulat, in Iroha, have you guys considered anything around interoperability so far? Any thoughts?
We have one project with kind of playing with interoperability with Bitcoin and Ethereum.
And can you perhaps briefly describe what that means and how you're thinking about it? What are the primitives that you need to implement in Iroha to enable those?
So basically, it's just federated two-way back sidechains.
Tell me more.
So basically, your peers in some organizations who are part of the consensus are also looking at the Bitcoin or Ethereum transactions, and you have some shared multi-signature wallet for that.
Okay.
So to enable the interoperability, the peers should be in kind of both blockchains.
So the peers should be in both blockchain in the sense, are you talking only about when you say peers, do you make a distinction between any participating entity, or what we would think of a client, or are you talking about validating nodes themselves?
Yeah, the validating nodes, the ones who participate in the consensus process.
Okay, so in your model, peers validating nodes should be part of both networks, right?
So they will be validating in one network, in some Iroha network, and they will be just clients to the other network. For example, Bitcoin, they will be only see some transactions. So basically, if you want to support transactions from Bitcoin to Iroha, you have some special wallet, let's say multi-signature wallet, and the peers of Iroha will be signing and they will be in control of this specific wallet. And when some guy from Bitcoin wants to transact from Bitcoin to Iroha, he will send to this special wallet in Bitcoin.
Okay. So if you want to, so taking that first use case, right? Let's say if you want to take the use case of a balance transfer from Iroha to Bitcoin, or I guess the simple use case is from Bitcoin to Iroha, how does that work?
So you first need to register, you need to get some Iroha account. And for that, for this account, we will create some specific wallet, Bitcoin wallet, associated with that account. And this association will be stored in Iroha blockchain.
Okay, so association between the Iroha identity. So is that just a pub key in Iroha as well, or
yeah.
Do you have anything?
Yeah, well, for Iroha, we have the naming. So the name and the domain name. So it's called account ID. And this account ID can have multiple public keys. So for that, the registering is creating the specific account ID.
Okay. And so you create an associated Iroha ID, account ID, and the Bitcoin wallet of that entity.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And
which
then,
is the...
Yeah, and then you give this wallet ID to the client, and each transaction to that wallet will be will say to the Iroha peers that some transition between Bitcoin and Iroha should happen.
So this is a Bitcoin wallet in Iroha still under the control of the client, or is this under the control of the Iroha system?
Yeah, it will be under the control of the whole system. So it will be multi-signature control of the peers.
Okay. The wallet. So when you say the wallet, the Bitcoin wallet, you're talking about a system Bitcoin wallet. Is that right?
No, some specific address. Like some address where you can send money.
Okay. So this would be quote unquote the escrow account of sorts?
Of what?
Is it a type of escrow account?
Yeah, kind of.
So, and is that multi-sig wallet created per account ID, or is that a shared resource that multiple account IDs use?
It will be created for a specific account ID, yes.
Okay. and give the wallet ID to the client. And okay, so, and then if he wants to transfer, so what in some amount of value from Bitcoin to Iroha, he sends that to that Bitcoin wallet?
Yes, exactly.
And now that Bitcoin wallet is multi-sig, and somehow that kind of immobilizes that Bitcoin, and then it transfers it to Iroha, is it?
Yeah.
Got it. So that this is per account. Okay. And so if for going the other way around, how do you do it? If there's some quote unquote value in Iroha, how do you?
Yeah, we for that, we have some specific also wallet in Iroha, which will transfer. And we have some specific command, which is transfer to other chain.
Okay.
Basically, client in Iroha will create transaction to transfer to other chain, and will specify to what chain, what wallet, and so on.
Is it the same wallet as the receiving wallet or a different one?
It could be a different one.
Okay. Even when you're interoperating with the same network for an account, for a specific account ID, you could have one incoming Bitcoin wallet and an outgoing Bitcoin wallet and so forth?
Yeah. So the same technology can be applied to basically any blockchain who supports multi-signature, multi-signature cryptography, and you don't even need smart contracts. If you have smart contracts, yeah, then you do the same pipeline using smart contracts.
If the receiving chain has smart contract, that could be used. So I guess this model is, the validators need to have an identity bound on both. So you create a system, entity which is a client on the other network, and then you bind that to that account, and on a per account basis, you kind of do those escrows and so forth.
Yeah.
So how does this compare to the primitives? So a question for, Mick Hart, everybody else. So how can we generalize that into what primitives would be useful how can we capture the, is that just a class of doing interoperability? Does it fall into some of the primitives we've been talking about?
Yeah, sorry, reaching for the mute button. How exactly do you want to generalize this?
So I'm just trying to capture, you know, so one way of doing it is just to have this kind of multi-sig, nodes in one network having, you know, the a bound identity in the other and so forth, right? So.
So I still don't see exactly how does this, like you need some kind of lock or commitment, right?
So, the question to.
If, for example, in Bitcoin, if you say that this specific wallet is multi-sig, which is controlled by, let's say, all the peers in some specific network, then it will create like automatic lock because nobody can spend these coins except if you have the multi-signature transaction to spend this coin. And you will have it only if the whole network agrees.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I must have missed that part earlier. If you're doing it by consensus, then yeah, that makes...
I think what the approach you described was that, they're bound to each account is a system account BTC wallet, which is multi-sig capable, right? So if, for instance, if you're transferring money from Bitcoin to Iroha, then the client is going to transfer into this quote-unquote escrow account, which is controlled, which is bound to whatever consensus in the Iroha network.
No, I understand how it works now. But yeah, this seems like a general value transfer, right? And I guess you can transfer smart contracts too, right? Because you can just have you can probably have some kind of like account that's, again, multi-sig that can create new smart contracts on a different chain, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Ram, you were asking for generalization, right? This is just a way of transferring value or smart contracts, right?
Yeah.
So that's how you would generalize this, I think. I mean, and again, this is one way to do it. There are other implementations, you know, other ways you could possibly do it as well.
So I'm just trying to tease out going the other way, right? So the what is that we need a way to, so this is the way in which, yeah, I guess this is an escrow mechanism, which is tied to consensus, right?
Yeah, I mean, the key point is that it can also do smart contracts. It can do more than objects, right?
Yes.
The downside is you have to involve the entire, it has to be a consensus step in and of itself rather than just having like a transaction. But again, this is an implementation detail.
I'm losing you there. So every transaction in either ledger has to go through consensus, right? Either way.
Sorry, what?
Any transaction on any ledger is going to have to go through consensus anyway, right?
Yes, but this one requires like a multi-sig on
both ledgers.
On multiple ledgers, right?
Yeah, now you're back to the problem of sort of externalizing state across ledgers.
There is also another possibility that you don't need consensus. You can only just you only need to have some part of the signatures. Let's say two-thirds plus one signatures of the peers. It doesn't need to go through the regular step of consensus. You just need to exchange the keys and collect them.
Sure.
Got it.
There are a lot of ways to do this, and I don't think we should get bogged down in the, like, it's not a thing for today to get bogged down in the implementation details.
Correct. So that's why I wanted to zoom out and say, what is the, you know, when we're talking about externalizing state and escrows and locks, you know, how does this map? I'm just going to do the reverse mapping. What is the, is there any changes to the functional things that we want to capture?
I mean, no, functionally, this is all like moving something from one ledger to another, right?
Yeah, that's a use case. So we want to go, going back to these things, right? You want to go use case, the requirement, and functional description.
The requirements here are very diverse, right? Like you might want to do this, you know, they're doing this one way. You know, I've seen other ways where you do it with kind of essentially lockable and unlockable commitments. In that, you know, that requires kind of more cryptography, but it has the advantage that you don't have to have everybody sign off on everything on both ledgers. Essentially you have to have some way of agreeing on essentially the state in two different blockchains.
What do you mean by lockable, unlockable commitments? Can you talk a little bit more?
So basically you want to do like a kind of multi-party computation, right? Where the output of the computation is you get something on one chain and I get something on the other, right?
Okay.
So.
I see. That's more complicated, I guess. It requires some MPC functions on both.
Or some MPC. Yeah, or some MPC-like functions, yeah. So it's a little more complicated to do, right? But it lessens some of the outside requirements of like the ledgers agreeing on the state. It means just the transactors have to agree, really, rather than the ledgers. But how the kind of protocol would work is I would give you something, like if you and I were doing a trade, I would give you some information and some proof that it was computed correctly, and it would be kind of a commitment to something that you could unlock later. And then you would give me you'd give me something like more in the clear that was like a transaction thing. But when I sort of activated it and posted on the blockchain, the information that I post to validate my transaction could necessarily be used to unlock the commitment on, so you could get what you want, if that makes sense. That was a pretty bad explanation, I think, but.
Maybe you can put in two lines in the notes page.
There are a number of these sort of multi-party computations on blockchain papers that have been written recently. I know Microsoft who've done this, for example.
You can think like Interledger, right, is a very basic example of this.
Right.
And obviously that can't handle things like smart contracts, but yeah, it's a simple case. So.
All right. So you mentioned in Iroha you have these two primitives. Do you have any kind of generic locking primitives?
No, right now, no.
Okay. And you know, when you're talking about externalizing state, right? So how would that apply to, does that come into the picture the way Iroha is doing it? I mean, that was one of the primitives we tried to capture, right?
Can you elaborate more on externalizing the state? I'm not quite getting it.
Mick, you want to jump in? And
yeah, so the notion of externalizing state is, how do you create a non-interactive proof of a commitment or a particular value in the state of a ledger? So how do I prove that a transaction has been committed to the ledger? In some sense, it's easy if you assume completely static populations of validators and that you can collect all of the signatures that are necessary for it. But at some level, you need some root of trust that you're basing back on, and some assertions about what those claims actually mean. We've been working on a paper on externalizing state, which I can kind of point you to, but we're doing this for the purpose of writing some of the off-chain contracts that would take advantage of existing state of ledgers across multiple ledgers. So.
Oh, okay. I get it. So I think in most of the cases, some Merkle proof and in the blockchain is used. Right now in Iroha, we don't have it. One of the ways, so we want to support the dynamic membership of the peers. And for that, the client needs to track the membership change. And for that one, you can have Merkle proof. And after that, since you know that what is the current state of peers, you can kind of just check the signatures.
And how do you know the current state of the peers? Yeah. Again, for non interactive proof, or something that's outside this, that's outside the ledger.
Oh, for non interactive.
Non interactive proof outside the ledger. I mean, and I'm not really looking for an answer. I'm just saying that particular problem, because that's the general form of the problem, turns out to be very hard, because you actually have to, even if I, you know, if I do something like I'm going to collect a bunch of signatures of the peers, I can collect the signatures from the peers, but how do I prove to the external that set of peers is in fact the set of validating peers for this network? So you end up with these sort of recursive proofs that get really ugly really fast.
Mick, I mean, you can always do an interactive proof if you have to.
Yeah.
You can, but you have to make certain assumptions about what you have for the interactive proof, right? I mean, the interactive proof requires you to actually have connections and be able to probe, right?
I guess, you know, if you're able to interact with the ledger itself, then obviously you can query the ledger, right?
You can. Well, okay, let's go back and, you know, while we're on this notion of proof, what does it mean to query a ledger? So a simple example is, you know, I'm a Bitcoin client. I want to prove that the transaction's been committed to the ledger. How do I prove that the transaction's been committed? I can go to one Bitcoin validator miner and ask, has it been committed? And they can say, yes, here's a Merkle proof for it. But all that really proves is that they have a chain that's been committed to that, without looking at, for example, the amount of work that's been accumulating, characteristics of the work. I don't know if it's part of the main chain. Right? So it turns out to be much harder, even in the case where you're doing interactive proofs.
Yeah, you want to, you know, if you want to do a strong query, you would want to have some threshold number of nodes that you...
Right, which again is an approximation, but it's not and we can come up with very reasonable approximations, but there's a difference between sort of proof and approximation. And now once you start in the approximation, now you're back in the sort of realm of, okay, what's the probability that this has been committed? So. Let me just... copy in the link to the, some of the things this I need to mark it as a draft, just to make sure nobody takes it too seriously. But All right. I hate putting full links in. Anyway, so I just dumped in a link to the paper we've been writing on this.
Where can I get the link?
It's currently in the notes for that Rom's been writing. I can, let me post it.
On Rocket Chat as well?
So I just posted it into the Zoom meeting. Is that, does that work for you, Bulat?
Thanks.
Okay.
So what's the equivalent though in you know, a permission ledger without, you know, if you have a consensus protocol without forking, can you just you know, query a node and be satisfied that you have because obviously Bitcoin
you can or cannot, depending again on what your threshold is for it. So if you have a fixed population of, let's call them validators, right? If you have a fixed population of validators, you can always go out and say that I want a threshold signature that corresponds to the consensus requirements for this particular ledger, right? So if I'm running PBFT over a population, so our root of trust is a population, and that population is fixed, then I can do, as soon as I get F+1 commits, and they're all consistent, then that constitutes a proof of state of consensus across the ledger, right? I mean, that's a fundamental characteristic of the population, or of the consensus. But if the population changes, so for example, we're having this conversation about Indy. So Indy can generate an externalization of credentials, right? But the population of signers, endorsers, validators in Indy is dynamic. And so in order to understand what the current population is, you have to verify that they have been added correctly. And so you end up with this crazy recursive problem. So in almost every circumstance that we keep coming back to, the cost of doing a verifiable proof is so expensive, a non-interactive verifiable proof is so expensive that we're just back to finding ways of doing approximations that have high probability. Like, for example, can I have an agent that I trust generate a set of signatures? Or can somebody come in and provide me with a current list of the validators that I should trust, and I use that as my basis for the approximation for it? So there's a bunch of things like that you can do that simplify it, that make it back into the realm of computability. But there's a difference between the kind of third-party approximation and the community. And that difference is subtle, but challenging.
I guess I will read your paper with more and to get the difference, but I see the problems you're pointing to. It essentially becomes a chain thing, right? So you can have the signature, but you know that, like everything else, you know, if you have to do everything, if you have to verify the whole chain, then
And that's, ironically, that's exactly that's exactly why coming up with a Bitcoin client that's a real client is so difficult. Because to really verify the state of transaction in a trustworthy way, the proof is the chain, which really sucks.
Yes. And I guess you can think of it as, Yeah, and even in Bitcoin, there's the light client and the full client and so forth, right? So,
which again are reflective of different trust relationships that you have.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
The full client basically says, "I'm going to only trust the community." The light client says, "I'm going to trust my peer to not do anything stupid."
Right.
With
and those by the way, are very reasonable approximations, right? So. They are approximations.
With Bitcoin also, you can kind of do better since, there is a proof of work and some, like the miners should do something with some number of zeros. So you can do non-interactive proof using that.
You can... Again, assuming that you've done the computations on the difficulty level and the other things in order to make sure, and that sort of, that's where you end up with this recursiveness of the proof. And I'm not sure, I mean, this goes back to, I don't know if the distinction's important because you could create these approximations that are really good and with high probability are the same thing. So, do you really need a full Bitcoin client in order to prove validity of transactions? Yes, but no. And I can't believe I'm the one that's getting hyper theoretical on you.
All right. So how do we take that back up, right? So the question we were asking was externalizing state and the approach that Iroha was taking with the multi-sigs is one way of, I mean, that's really not non-interactive at this point, right? All right. So we are coming up on the end of the hour. If we go back to the interop paper, what's the next step there? Do we want to, is there anything new in terms of sections that we want to kind of add or modify, or are we okay with what we have so far? Pulat, have you? Do you have the link to the interop paper?
Is it the it's not the ledger system identity, right? It's something.
No.
Different. Oh no, I don't.
I just posted the link on the Rocket Chat channel, Aqua Group Rocket Chat channel.
Oh,
are you on the channel?
No, I think I'm not part of the group.
Okay, let me post it. On here as well, so you have it. But the Rocket Chat is a good place to kind of participate as well, since we use. Ideally, we wanted to use that because even those who are not on the Zoom call will have a record of what's happening there. So that's the reason we decided to use that. but I'll post it here as well. So if you can take a look at it and, you know.
Yeah, I think I got it. I see now the group.
Okay.
So I have Rocket Chat now.
Cool, great, fantastic. And we can, you know, hopefully the next time around we'll have Stan as well, so we can continue to make progress on that. Sounds good, guys. I think we are at the end of the hour. We had a smaller group today. Maybe it's because we're still recovering from the face-to-face last week. So hopefully I'll ping Gordon on the system identities paper and make sounds like you're providing the input on Sawtooth. And Bulat, if you can take a look at Viroha.
I believe I have the paragraphs you need in there if you want to take a look at them.
Oh, so fantastic.
Dan, wow, and, okay. Like I said, Dan and I were hacking away while you guys were talking. Sorry.
No worries. Sounds good. Sounds good. So we can probably review it offline and send you comments, and we can hopefully have Gordon start writing the publishable version of the paper next. Good progress. Any other thoughts, comments? All right. And Bulat, really appreciate you joining and looking forward to your continued participation.
Yeah, thank you. Me too.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, y'all.
You guys. Bye.